Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Mafidigansini, and today I'm talking with former member of Congress from Arizona, Ron Barber. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Keith. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. So I've been trying to pinpoint how we know each other, where exactly we met.
Well, that's a good question for a memory that's not so great anymore. It could have been through your dad, Dino. It might have been through politics. It might have been through some of my disability work before I left the Arizona Department of Developmental Disabilities. I'm not sure, but it's one of those, maybe all of them.
Yeah. So for those listeners who don't know your extensive backstory in working and advocating on behalf of people with disabilities, please tell us about what got you involved in working on behalf of people with disabilities.
Well, I've always felt, even before I got into the work directly, that disability rights were almost like the last frontier of civil rights. We've had a lot of battles for voting rights and for desegregation and so on. But even with that, people with disabilities, particularly people with developmental disabilities, oftentimes were sent away to institutions and separated from their community. So I got into that work, first of all, as a civil liberties issue for me. I've been involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s, and I just felt this was a natural extension. My first job in disabilities work was actually with Head Start. I was the Head Start director in Southern Arizona, and we got a federal demonstration grant to show how good it was to integrate children with disabilities into the so-called typical population. And we brought a lot of kids with disabilities into the Head Start program. Then I left that job and went to work for a state agency. It's called the Division of Developmental Disabilities. It was under a Department of Economic Security. And I started out as a community outreach director and then later became the district director or administrator. And ended up being from there, state director for the agency. And my job, as I saw it, was to bring a new set of values to the disability services in our state. Unfortunately, most of the people that were being served who had a developmental disability were in institutions in our state. And by the way, I have a little friend here. You see her head popping up from time to time. Her name is Maisie. And the reason that she's on my lap is that our dog sadly passed away about a month and a half ago. And we were very sad. And Maisie came into our lives from a rescue. And she has really brought love into our home. And just, she's been healing us from the loss. Anyway, so I went into the Division of Developmental Disabilities in 1974. That was at the beginning nationally of a movement to get people out of institutions and back into their communities, or even better, to keep them in their communities so they wouldn't have to go into institutions. And my job initially was to run a small institution in Southern Arizona, the Arizona Training Program at Tucson, and then to provide an array of home-based services for people who were still with their families. So what we did, we started a process. Actually, a lawsuit really helped us with that. A lawsuit by what was then called the Association for Retarded Citizens, which demanded that we downsize the largest institution in Arizona. It had 1,400 people in an institution that was built for 300. The staffing wasn't much better than it was for 300. It was a dreadful, dreadful place. People were in seclusion. They were medicated so they couldn't behave in any way. And that was the target of the lawsuit. But the lawsuit also said we should reduce populations in the other two institutions, each of them, one of the ones I was running and the other one up in Phoenix, which was about the same size, 200 beds, day programs, that kind of thing. Long story short, we moved towards deinstitutionalization. Nobody left the institutions unless they had a place to go with the level of help that they needed, 24/7 if necessary, whatever it was. And even, I think in some ways more importantly, we worked very closely with families to give them the services that they needed to be able to keep their children or even adults at home as long as they wanted. So that was a revolution in Arizona. And I'll make one final comment. We could open it up further for further questions. But in 1985, Arizona finally got its act together and decided to bring in Medicaid funds for long-term care services. And it's the last state in the union to do so. So we were in a very fortunate position as directors of the agency that we could write a plan to use those monies in an entirely different way from how they'd been used before. So virtually no money was allocated for institutional care. Most of the money was allocated for home and community-based services. And in the end, we were able to close two institutions, the Phoenix and Tucson one, dramatically reduce the population at the one in the middle of the state, in the Coolidge area, from 1,400 down to 100. And those people, some of those people still live there, there will be no new admissions. So eventually that place will close as well. The whole idea is this. If people with disabilities are going to realize their potential to be the most productive they can be in whatever way they want to be, they can't be locked up in an institution. They have to be with the community. They have to be able to go to a grocery store or to a movie or use public transportation. And all of those things are critical to getting people to have a normal life. The concept that we used was called normalization. It was created in Omaha, Nebraska, by a psychologist, Wolf Wolfensberger, and it found its way to Arizona out of Nebraska. And we were one of the leading states in the country for deinstitutionalization and home and community-based services. That's how I got involved with the whole game.
So many questions. Did you just say that Arizona was the last state in the union to what?
To use Medicaid funds for long-term care services.
I heard that.
Yeah, you heard it right. You know, and because of that, there were thousands of people on waiting lists for services in Arizona. And we finally were able to pretty much eliminate those waiting lists when we got the federal funds.
So before, when you started, you mentioned that out of all the institutions left in Arizona, I believe there are two. How many were there at the beginning?
There were five, if you count the private one, and I think that's one you're including in the two. The Coolidge facility, the largest, which was so overcrowded, is down to 100 now. The other institution is in Phoenix, and it's a private entity. And it has been under extreme and correct surveillance and investigation since a horrible incident happened a few years back where a young woman who was profoundly, what we used to say, profoundly retarded in those days, but intellectual disability and all is the new description. She was raped by one of her caregivers at night, probably more than once. She got pregnant, and then it took a long time for them to figure out that she was pregnant, and then she delivered a baby. But the issue of her rape became a huge scandal, as you can imagine. And that brought scrutiny to the institution. The CEO was fired, And so he should have been, because he covered a lot of this stuff up and then also was doing some other things that weren't legal with the money. And he's gone. And now there's a whole reform effort underway to try to improve services and maybe to downsize. Eventually, I'd like to see that one close too. And the Coolidge facility will eventually close when the folks who are there pass. There's no need to segregate people in an institution to serve them. In fact, the opposite is true, that this service is what happens when they're in an institution.
So how long did you work for the Department of,
Developmental disabilities? 32 years.
32 years. And so what did you do next, and how did you choose to leave that job that you were in for over 30 years? And was that a rough decision?
It was a very difficult decision in one way, but in another way, it was an easy decision. I decided that I would retire and go to work to help a young woman who was a state senator. Her name is Gabrielle Giffords. And
Never
Gabby,
heard of her.
I know, nobody's heard
Guilty,
of her,
of
right?
course.
But Gabby, I saw Gabby when I was in the state job and in the division, and I saw her at work. When we had town halls for people with disabilities and their families, we would try to schedule those at least once or twice a year for legislators to listen to their issues and concerns. We had one that I was attending, and I noticed something very unique about Gabby. First of all, she was well prepared. She came with great questions. She'd done her homework. But then when everybody else left, all the other legislators left, and the people with disabilities and their families were still there, Gabby didn't leave. She went down from the stage and started meeting all of the families, all of the people with disabilities, one-on-one, two-on-one, hugging, talking, learning. And I thought, that is different. Everybody else left and she's still here wanting to know more. So I never forgot that. And then when I heard she was running for Congress, I was on my way back from Phoenix from a meeting, and I heard it on the radio, and I thought, oh my goodness, I'd love to help her. I just felt I had to do that. And so I went home and I said to my wife, Nancy, I really have to do this. I need to retire from my state job and go to be a volunteer on Gabby's staff. And she said, does that mean we don't have any income? I said, yeah, that's kind of what happened there. We'll get by, but I need to help her because she has the kind of vision and intellect and caring and full heart that we need in elected officials, particularly in Congress at the time. So I left there. I became her volunteer outreach director. I then we won the election, and in November, after the election was over, Gabby asked me to be her district director, which meant I was in charge of all district operations back in her home district in Tucson and surrounding counties. And so that's what I did for 3 years. She got into office in 2007. And in 2010, she won her third term. And then a terrible thing happened about a month, not even a month, 2 or 3 weeks after she was sworn in. She came home to do a public event with her constituents. We called it Congress on Your Corner. A gunman showed up intent on killing her. He tried, shot her in the head, shot me 2 times, shot many people, 19 in all, 6 of whom died. Gabby shouldn't have lived, quite frankly, because of the way that, she was shot or where she was shot. But she's a fighter, and with help from really an outstanding medical team in Tucson and then rehab in Houston, she's back. But she realized after a year that she really couldn't give 100% to the job. She really needed to focus on her rehab. And so she turned to me and said, "Ron, you've got to run for my seat in the special election." And I said, "Oh my goodness, I won't do that." But she fought, talked me into it.
Image last words.
Yeah, you got that right. My wife said famous last words as well. So anyway, I did run eventually. It took a lot of convincing. I won the special election, so I served out the rest of her term, won re-election, served 2 more years. And then in my third election in 2014, I lost by 167 votes out of 250,000 votes. So it was a close race to say the least. And we had a recount and all of that. But eventually, I had obviously the right decision just to concede. I mean, today you have a lot of politicians who say, "I won't concede because it was a fraudulent election." That's nonsense. When you lose, you lose. When you win, you win. And when you lose, you are a gracious loser and call your opponent and you wish them well, which is exactly what I did.
So, how would your time in Congress, because you were also recovering from that incident? I mean, so many people were injured or killed during that horrible attack. What would you like transitioning from a unspeakable tragedy, a local tragedy, to serving in the national halls of Congress?
Well, it was a wonderful time, actually. It was before the current divisions and polarization have taken our country into a totally different direction in terms of politics. I followed Gabby's lead. She was always willing and able to work with Republicans, and I did too. I was a member of the bipartisan working group, 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats, who worked together to sponsor bills to reopen the government. And we were quite successful in a lot of ways because we represented two different parties with different policies and all. Okay, so there we are. So anyway, when I went there, it was a much different time. We were beginning to see some elements of what we see today. The Tea Party was on the rise, and some of the what they did was pretty ugly. They surrounded Gabby's office, then my office, with some of the most hateful messages you could imagine. They were really the precursor to what we see today, but they were, if you can believe it, a lot less aggressive and vi vicious than what we see today in politics. But Congress was different then, even though the Tea Party element was beginning to make their way and take their positions and influence politics. But today it's so different. I mean, I had a lot of Republican colleagues who I love working with, good people, principled people, people of integrity. And I've worked for many years as a student in college at the university with my Republican counterparts, worked very well on things that we agreed on and, decided to leave the things we disagreed on aside. It's very difficult to do that now. Although in my new work, we're trying to bring people together, and that's why I'm doing the work that I am for the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia.
So before we get to that, the cornerstone of the disability rights movement, the Americans with Disability Act of 1990, was signed into law under a Republican president, George H.W. Bush, and
Right.
then it was updated by his son, George W. Bush. But nowadays, there's almost not a prayer or a snowball chance, to use another colorful phrase, that the ADA would get passed today. Where do you think we went wrong? Do you think we're ever going to get back to a point where we can pass major bipartisan legislation that, even though half of it is underfunded, it's still send a statement? Do you ever think there's any hope that we will get past the gridlock that we find ourselves in nowadays and back when the Tea Party was prominent, to actually be able to do sweeping bipartisan work together?
Well, I am an eternal optimist, Keith. I believe that things can get better always if we work at it together. I still have a lot of Republican friends who decry what's happened to their party, want to see it change. They've left their party sometimes to become independent or even Democrats. Some of them have stayed Republican because they believe they have to work from the inside to try to change and to go back, not to change so much as go back to the days of the good old GOP, and which I experienced growing up as a young adult in Tucson and then in Congress when I went there, as I said. So what has to happen is pretty dramatic. The people who are election deniers, the people who are, I think, in many respects, racist because of the things they say and do, the book banning and the not able to teach American history as it is, sanitizing it to take out references to slavery and that kind of thing. Those things will eventually fade away. But they have to be, it has to be because a number of people who are in that place, in that with that point of view, if they run for election, they're defeated. It's the only way we can send the message that those ideas, those policies aren't who America is about, what America is about. So I believe that that can happen. We saw evidence of that in 22, last election, when all of the Trump endorsed candidates at a high level in Arizona lost their election, governor, secretary of state, attorney general. But we still have a legislature here that is very right wing, very MAGA, if you will. And that has to be a change that's made at the ballot box too. So I believe we can come back from this. You know, one of the things about politics is the pendulum swings, left, middle, right, so forth. Right now, it's sort of extreme to the right, unfortunately, not a majority of Americans, but a vocal minority who make their presence known by, you know, some harsh rhetoric and taunting people and lying about what's really going on. So those people have to have defeated the ballot box because that's how we take our country back, not through violence or threats of violence like some of them do, but because we uphold the American values that say every person gets a right to vote. And when you win, and when you lose, you lose. I mean, basic stuff, you know. So I believe we can get there. It'll be long and it'll be painful, but I'm confident that we can get back to that place where America used to be, that I think we all felt very good about.
I think I know the answer to the question I'm about to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you miss being in Congress?
I miss being in the Congress that was in 2012 when I first got elected and served until 2014. I miss that. I miss the collegiality between Democrats and Republicans. I miss that we passed some major legislation, bipartisan legislation that couldn't happen today. I miss personally being able to serve the constituents back home because that's really, in some ways, the most important job of a member of Congress is to be an attendant to the citizens, the constituents, the people they represent. And I felt very strongly, as did Gabby Giffords, that that's really the number one job, is to serve the people, veterans who need help, Social Security applicants who are in trouble, all kinds of people, people who need passports and so on. That's why we're here, to serve. And the policies that are being enacted or trying to be enacted now really are the opposite of service, because they're cutting a lot of things away, or they would. The fact that we have a Senate that's Democratic and a House that's Republican by a slight margin and a president that's Democrat saves us from some of the excesses of what the House of Representatives majority would do. And we have to make sure that we work hard as Democrats, independents, and Republicans to elect the right people, people who may differ in their policies from one another, but who are dedicated to one idea, and that is that the American democracy is in trouble and it's worth saving. You know, as an immigrant myself, I feel very strongly about the American system of government. I think it's one of the best, if not the best in the world. And I'm very passionate about protecting that and restoring that. So that's where I head, that's where I go, and I look for opportunities to do that.
So you just said you're an immigrant. Where did your family immigrate from?
My mother's family are Irish. They came to England during World War II, quite frankly, because of the economics. There was work there, rebuilding London after the bombing and, you know, repairing the railroad systems and all of that. And so I grew up in a blue-collar family in a blue-collar part of London called Camden Town, where we had a mix of Irish, Greek, and Italians living in proximity to one another, getting along well and doing all of that. So that's how I grew up, as a blue-collar kid in London. My mother, who was a war widow from World War II, married an American GI. He was an airman, and he brought all of us, myself and my mom, to Tucson, because he was stationed at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. So here's this kid from, you know, very low-income family in London. I get on a plane. I go with my stepdad and my mom. We land in New Jersey, and eventually we make our way across the country, going through state after state to Tucson. It was a culture shock, but a very good one, because I had grown up watching cowboy movies, and I thought the Wild West was still the Wild West. Well, it sort of is, but not in the way I thought about it. So I came here, I fell in love with Tucson, became a desert rat, met my wife in high school, and eventually we got married, and we just celebrated our 56th wedding anniversary. So I'm very confident that we can.
Congratulations. That's quite a number.
It is a good number. You're right. I'm a very lucky guy. I met her and fell in love with her in high school, and eventually she agreed to marry me. So I'm very honored by that. We have a wonderful family, 2 daughters, 5 grandkids, all of that. So, you know, life is good, except I look around me and I see this vitriol, this harsh rhetoric, these attacks, and I'm just worried, because those people who do that are not only trying to destroy democracy as we know it, but are also intimidating people to the point where they're afraid to speak out in case they might be, you know, attacked, not only verbally, but actually. And we've seen a lot of that recently with attacks, you know, people threatening to kill candidates and that kind of thing. So this is not the America that I came to or I naturalized in. It's America that was, but it has to be again.
So what you mentioned earlier, what are you doing with the Carter Center that is keeping you busy? And is it a natural progression, like all your professional life seems to be?
Right. Well, you know, I have people remind me that I've retired probably 4 or 5 times now. Once the voters retired me by those 167 votes, so I count that too. I really was going to retire in 2020, because I really felt that it was time to spend a lot more time with family, grandkids. I've got 5, as I mentioned, and I love being around them all. So Mark Kelly came along after he won his election as senator and asked me to be his district director or Southern Arizona director. And I said, no, Mark, I'm retiring. He said, give me a year, give me a year. So I gave him all of 21 and I retired, technically retired in December of 21. And then 2 weeks later, I got a call from the Carter Center, Jimmy Carter's foundation in Atlanta, Georgia. And they asked me ultimately to head up a project that they were initiating in Arizona. And I have a Republican colleague up in Maricopa County who I work with to put this together. And basically, what we're trying to do is restore trust in the American election system. And we do that by pushing back on conspiracy theories, by when we hear fact-free statements. We try to bring facts to bear so people will know what's real and what's not. We are concerned about the threats that are being made to election officials and volunteers and workers, and we're pushing back and working with law enforcement to protect them. You know, it's gotten so bad for election officials that in the last year, all 12 of the 15 counties in Arizona have lost through resignation their election officials. That's a lot of institutional memory that's gone. And the reason that they're not wanting to do that anymore is because they've been threatened with violence. Their families have been threatened. Some of it's the ugliest kind of threat you could imagine. Now, I wouldn't, when I was in Congress, I got a lot of threats too. It's just kind of part of the game. But you don't expect people who are doing the work of protecting and ensuring the survival of our democracy. You don't expect them to be attacked. They're good people, they're public service people. Servants trying to do a good job. So that's what we have, and we call it the Arizona Democracy Resilience Network. We have over 300 people. We're nonpartisan. We have Republican conservatives and independents and Democrats, faith leaders, business people. We look like Arizona, and the people who are on our group are dedicated to the same principles I mentioned. And that is, we believe, for example, that America's democratic norms are being eroded, that there are people who really prefer a different kind of government. I would su suggest a government that's autocratic and not democratic. And we need to fight back and we need to restore trust. Now, when I told my daughters that I wasn't going to retire and I was going to do this work, they said, Dad, you were going to play and spend time with your grandkids. I said, I know, but let me tell you why I'm doing this or what it's all about. And after they heard my story about it, they said, of course you have to. And I agree that here's the thing. Many of us are unhappy about what's going on in our country. Many of us are afraid for the future of the country. What we can't do is get pessimistic and bury our heads in the sand. What we have to do is engage. You know, I think Teddy Roosevelt once said, if you're not in the battle, you're not doing anything. And when I told my daughters that, I said, okay, Dad, you have to do this. And so I've been doing it now since 22, early 22, and we'll be working this through 2024 for the presidential election. And I believe we can and have already made a difference by having a new voice, a different voice, a nonpartisan voice, push back on some of the nonsense that we hear, some of the really ugly things that are being said that are not helpful, just really damaging our country and the people in it.
So, I'm gonna ask another question I know the answer to, but for the one or two people who don't know, who we're talking about, who you just mentioned, who is Mark Kelly?
Who is what? Sorry.
Who is Mark Kelly?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mark Kelly, I should have said it better. Is the junior senator from Arizona, a former astronaut, and the wife, and sorry, his wife is Gabby Giffords, and so he decided to run for the seat that used to be held by Senator McCain. And he won. He actually beat the person that beat me in 2014, Martha McSally. He won the Senate seat, and he just won re-election for 6 years. He is smart. He's a moderate. He really does his homework. He's a guy who believes in data and making decisions based upon data. So we have a really great representative or senator, and you know, obviously I'm biased, but he's doing a great job in a way that's centrist. And I think that's what America and what Arizona particularly needs.
So I asked you, do you miss Congress? Do you miss working at the Department for Developmental Disabilities? Or does that job where you got your start, to use a phrase, seem like a lifetime ago or several lifetimes?
Well, you described it well. It does seem like a lifetime ago, because I left in 2006, January 2006. And I, as far as I was concerned at the time, it was my job I was going to retire from, but not then. I was going to, you know, retire maybe another 10 years later or something. But there was something that really was so appealing about the candidacy of then State Senator Giffords. I just couldn't resist helping her, because I believe that she represents then and now the kind of elected official that we want, someone who's honest and transparent, someone who is moderate in terms of their political views, someone who looks out, stands up for rights, for example, a woman's right to control her own reproductive health, very strong issue for Gabby and for me too. There are clear differences between what she believes, what I believe, and the current Republican legislature. Fortunately, we have Republican governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, and that has really rescued us from even worse problems.
Wait.
No, I do miss the work we did in developmental disabilities. I feel very honored to have had the privilege to lead the state and to lead the region in getting people the heck out of institutions and back into their community where they belong. I have to tell you a little anecdote about that.
Yeah.
When I was elected to Congress, I had an office in DC, of course, as well as in the district. And I just have to give you a little bit of a backstory first. When I first took over the institution in Tucson, I saw our job as getting people out of the large facility I mentioned earlier, where it had 1,400 people, to bring them to Tucson, to give them the skills that they needed, and then to get them out of the institution in Tucson into the community. So that was our mission. And we did it for hundreds and hundreds of people. So anyway, back to my office in DC, I'm sitting in my office and my chief of staff comes in and said, Ron, there's a young woman in the lobby. She says she knows you and she'd like to say hi. So I said, sure. And I walked out and I was blown away. Sitting in the lobby was a young woman that we had gotten out of the large institution, had brought into the Tucson facility for maybe 2 or 3 months, then moved her into her own apartment, got her a job in the community. And here she was in Washington, D.C. And she was there leading a group of self-advocates to lobby Congress on behalf of people with disabilities. To me, that was more than enough justification for what we were doing. I mean, it was bad enough to get, you know, bad situation, get people out. But to see her progress when she had been locked away for so many years, to see her progress as a citizen of our community, earning money, paying taxes, having her own place, I was overjoyed. And I knew in a moment, that's really what it was all about. And what she was able to show me was that we were doing the right thing.
Before we go on, don't we have a Democratic leadership in the state of Arizona with our new governor? Yeah, I heard I thought you'd said Republican for a second, not
No,
that
she's a
that's,
Democrat.
yeah.
She was the Secretary of State. She's now the governor. Her name is Katie Hobbs,
Yeah.
the Democrat, as I mentioned, and so is the Attorney General, and so
Yeah.
is the Secretary of State. If the people who were their opponents had won, we would be in a very bad place, because
Yeah.
all three of them were endorsed by Donald Trump. They were all extreme MAGA people. They denied the election, it was
Yeah.
fair and safe and all of that, and they're still doing it. They're crying from the outside looking in, but we have a really fine group of people in those state positions.
And to be fair, we're not being partisan at all. I mean, Senator McCain
Oh,
and
yes.
Senator Barry Goldwater were two of the, dare I say, large classic Republican senators, and
So right.
they both did wonderful things for Arizona. As I mentioned before, the cornerstone of disability legislation, the Americans with Disability Act of 1990, was signed into law by a Republican president
Right.
and then updated several years later by another Republican president. To go off of the example you just illustrated of thoughts of the self-advocate that you had helped many years before who showed up in DC. If there are any aspiring self-advocates listening to this episode, what would be a few action points that you would recommend that someone who is just starting out advocating for themselves and for other people with disabilities to take?
Well, that's a great question. It's a big question in terms of what people need to do or want to do. First of all, you're not alone. If you're an advocate for yourself or other people with disabilities, there are thousands, in fact, millions of people across the country who have a disability of one kind or another. And some of those disabilities are invisible, or at least appear to be. Mental health issues, for example, can often be invisible. Hearing and vision losses, those tend to be, not obvious to the world. But there are organizations across the spectrum of all of the disabilities that are volunteer groups for the most part, nonprofits, that are advocating with state legislatures and Congress for better treatment and support for people with disabilities. And I would urge people who are looking for any kind of involvement, you're welcome to do it on your own, and that's great, but you can find a lot of support in these organizations. So look for them in your state and your community, and see if they can use you as a volunteer, or you can do some work with them on their board. If you're working individually, it's about showing up. And there are a variety of ways of doing that. I mean, the obvious ways are emails to your elected officials, phone calls to their office. And let me tell you what happens when you do that, particularly to a congressional office, which gets thousands of those kinds of messages a month. They are all read by people who are on the staff of the member of Congress or the senator. And they are reported to that individual every week. So this is. This many people called about Social Security, or this many people called about Veterans Affairs, or this many people called about rights protections. And so the representative or the senator gets an aggregate number of how many people called in. So numbers do matter. And if you get a lot of people writing in and you can help organize that with other people, that's going to get more attention. And then the best always is showing up. Showing up in their DC office, like my friend Sherry did. Showing up at the district office. Showing up at an event in the in your congressman or your senator's state or district. And, you know, what we were doing the day of that shooting was what we called Congress on Your Corner. And that was an opportunity for constituents to meet with their representative one-on-one or two-on-one and to say personally without any filter, this is my concern. That's a wonderful way to get it to their attention without going through somebody to get it to them, you know, unfiltered information directly from the constituent. Now, I have to say that because of the shooting and because of the concern about threats towards elected officials, so those events are not as frequently done as they used to be. But that doesn't mean that there aren't events that your member of Congress will hold that are community events that you can go to or town halls that you can go to. Standing up and standing out, it really is what we have to do. And I know it's difficult if you've never done it before, but it's relatively easy in the end. If you know, if you can do an email, find their email address, send them an email. If you can find their phone number, call their district office, which is usually the best place to make a call because that is where they live. And then when you have an opportunity to meet them in person, do it. You know, self-advocacy to me is one of the most important movements that has happened in the disability rights movement. I learned something a long time ago when I was listening to self-advocates when I was in the disability world, and that is nothing about us without us. And I use that over and over again, not just for people with disabilities, but for anybody. If people say, oh, the public isn't interested or we don't need to contact people about this issue, I would say you're wrong if you're an elected official. And especially you're wrong if you don't include the people who are affected by your actions, by your policies, by your votes. And you have to, I think, create, as an elected official, opportunities through advisory councils and so on for people to speak to you regularly. And speaking of advisory councils, most members of Congress and members of the Senate have them around certain issues. Some have them on disability issues. Some have them on veterans issues, some have them on military matters, some have them on aging issues. And when you contact your local office, say, is there an advisory committee or council that the senator or the member of Congress has that I could be considered for? Lots of ways to get through. The most important thing, though, is taking action. It's easy to feel intimidated because it's new and it's different and it's maybe you don't feel like you know what to do or say, but there are plenty of organizations that can help you put together your statement. But standing up for people, yourself and others, is critical to making change.
So we talked about a lot during this episode, and I want to thank you for your time. I hope that both people with disabilities and those who have yet to discover and embrace their own disabilities listen to this episode. As my guests, what do you hope that people with disabilities take away from what we've talked about? And what do you hope that people who have yet to discover their own disabilities take away from this episode?
Let me take the second question first. You know, the term coming out is often thought about when we are discussing people's sexual orientation or gender identification, and that's commonly how it's used. But there are people with disabilities who, first of all, may not know that they have a disability, so you need to get some good evaluations to determine that. But it's also true that people with disabilities have been disenfranchised for so long that they don't think they have a voice, or that if they do, anyone will listen to it. I can assure you that people will listen to you if you have, if you take the step to speak out on your own behalf. And this, the first question, I think, was what do we hope will change? I mean, maybe I misread that question. Is that right?
So what do you hope that people who have yet to discover their own disabilities take away from what we've talked about in this episode?
Sure. Well, as I said, you know, if you suspect or a family member suspects you might have a disability, it's important to get an evaluation or evaluations to determine that so you know. But most people do know. You know, they may not know what to call it or how to deal with it or how to treat it, so forth. But that's why you have to engage with agencies that provide services, like the Division of Developmental Disabilities in Arizona. Offices all across the state, you can go in and apply for services, and that will get you into a system that will help you with everyday living. So it's important to step up. And as I've said, to step out. Easily said, harder to do, because there's so many barriers and blockades. And people with disabilities, they've experienced for all of their lives that they're treated differently. You know, when I think about what happens in a restaurant, for example, a person with, let's say, an obvious disability walks in with their family or with a friend, they sit down and they look at the menu and they want to order. And oftentimes the server will turn to the companion and say, and what would he or she like? The right answer for that companion is, why don't you ask him or her? But people make assumptions that because you have a disability, you can't make your own decisions or you don't know what the hell's going on. And that's not true. You know, when we talk about what it used to annoy me a lot was when people say to say about a person with a developmental disability that they had a mind like a 5-year-old child. And I'm saying, wait a minute. This woman is 45 years old. She's had 45 years of life experiences. Some of them have not been very good, been very challenging and stigmatizing. She's not a 5-year-old, and don't go there. And that's part of the problem we have in our culture is that people just don't know, and they dismiss people with disabilities as not being able to talk about stuff or have an opinion about stuff or even make their own decisions. And the worst example is when somebody in a restaurant, and this is a friend maybe who's trying to be helpful, can I cut your meat? God almighty, that's worse. No, you may not cut my meat. I'm going to do it myself. Now, if the person asks for help, that's a whole different story. But what I'm using these examples for is to say what something that people with disabilities know from their own lives. There's a stigma attached to it, the disability. There's an assumption that many people make that they can't really do anything, or what they can do is limited. And they get talked to like babies or kids when they're adults. We have a lot of more work to do. We've got some good laws in place, as you've mentioned, ADA, disability rights laws, that kind of thing. But we still got a long way to go. And I would have to say that one of the worst areas of stigmatization is people who are living with a mental health issue.
Yeah.
You know, it's particularly true for first responders and people in the military who have been diagnosed with PTSD because of being in combat and just being in the worst situations. And there's a sort of a culture still in the military that you don't go and say, I need mental health help, because next thing you know, you're going to be discharged. So people avoid coming out that way, you know, so seeking help. So after I was shot and was diagnosed with PTSD, I decided one of the best things that I could do was to take my story on the road. And I talked to groups all across the country about PTSD. And my message was, it's real and it can be treated and you can live with it and manage it. And don't give up. You can't, there are ways to get better. And I felt really that was important for me as a person who was in the world of politics. And when I was running for office, and a person who now had a disability, if you will, PTSD, and my leg that doesn't work very well, it was important for me to be on the stage out there talking to folks. My staff who were managing my campaign said, oh, Ron, you don't want to do that because people will say, assume that you don't know what you're doing because you have PTSD. I said, that's exactly why I need to do it. Because people need to hear from someone who's living with the issue to know that they're still okay. They can still talk, they can make decisions, they can do good things. And so I've been very devoted to trying to demolish stigmatization. In fact, right after the shooting in the ICU, my family and I made a decision and we were going to start a nonprofit. And we ended up calling it the Fund for Civility, Respect, and Understanding. And one of our missions was to address bullying in schools, which I think lead to a lot of significant issues later in life. And then the other was to try to do something about the stigma of mental illness. And so this is really important that we treat people as who they are. You're Keith, you're not your disability. I'm Ron, I'm not my disability. We are people and we're our name first. You know, people say the disabled. That's really not how you should talk about people who are living with a disability. It's demeaning. So for me, it's still a mission, both in terms of civil rights generally and protecting the rights of people with disabilities and dealing with stigma that prevents people from getting treatment. I feel very inspired by all of these ideas and the people that I've had a chance to work with. It's a great life to be able to be engaged this way and to actually hope that you're making a difference.
So, before I let you go, what do you hope that, and my phone just went off, they always go off when you don't need them to, and don't go off when you need them to. So, what do you hope that people with disabilities take away from this episode? And the last question is, if someone wants to get in touch with you or find out more about your nonprofit or the work you're doing with the Carter Center, how can they find out about those initiatives?
Let me give you my email address, which is the Carter Center address. And it will be my email for the next year and a half. It's Ronald, R-O-N-A-L-D, dot Barber, B-A-R-B-E-R, at Carter Center, all one word, dot org. So it's Ronald.Barber at Carter Center, one word, dot org. And I will be able to respond to any of your inquiries through that email, particularly about my work with the Carter Center and what we're trying to do. You know, the Carter Center, or the family, I should say, Rosalind and Jimmy Carter, were very dedicated, particularly to mental health services. Unfortunately, Mrs. Carter, former First Lady, does have dementia now, and her husband, the president, is in home hospice because of medical issues. But they have dedicated their life to public service, and that's why they formed the Carter Center, so that we could have people doing work in other countries to prevent disease, to help people stabilize their aspirations for a democracy. And I'll finish with this. In 2020, it was obvious to the Carter Center that the work they were doing on democracy building overseas needed to be brought home because of what was happening with people trying to destroy our democracy in this country. And so they launched the in four states, Arizona being one of the four, North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida being the other three, and now Michigan and New Mexico have been added. we have presence in all states, all of those states, and we're trying to reach out to people in other states in a less formal way. So we're here to do everything we can to put our democracy back in place. It's the best government system in the world. We need not to let anybody destroy it.
And Ron, what do you hope that people with disabilities take away from everything we've talked about in this episode?
Well, I hope that they know already, but they need to know that there are people like me who now has a disability. Didn't when I started this work, you have allies, and we're here to respect you, to listen to you, to be driven by what you think is the most important agenda. It's not my agenda, it's your agenda. I want to know more about that. I hope they take away that people without a disability and many others who have one that may be not obvious are advocates too, that we can get together and be a force. There is a thing in our society or in our culture that says that, you know, numbers matter, and it does matter that you show up yourself as a single person. And it's also important that you rally around other people and have the force of numbers. But most of all, I want you to be hopeful. Hopeful that we will change our country's current polarization and divided nature, that we will get people back in government who go there to do the work of the people, not their own ego-driven work. You know, as I said earlier, an extreme optimist. Not everybody feels that way, but I believe that if we get together as a society, those of us who believe in this democracy of ours, we can bring it back stronger than ever. And we can put those people who want to have autocratic government in their place. That's not who we are as a country. But we need everybody speaking up about that. And people with disabilities have a strong voice, and they need to use it.
Thank you so much, Ron, for your time today and for the decades upon decades of steadfast work on behalf of people with disabilities and advocating for them and their well-being. Thank you very much, my friend.
Yeah, I want to thank you, Keith. This podcast is wonderful, what you're doing here, because you're reaching a lot of people who otherwise might not be listening to podcasts. You did a great job today. I'm pleased to have been with you, and I thank you for the opportunity to be on your podcast.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guest, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, and share the podcasts. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2023.